Hey, it's the JRR You Talking to Me podcast. I'm your host, Rob Law. With me, as always, is my co-host, Jude Fox. Jude, are you talking to me tonight about trolling the rings?
I've been immersing myself in that hatred of the fandom community all week long in preparation for this.
Well, yes, we had to put on our hazmat suits and get in there and check out the... We noticed an overwhelming amount of negative criticism coming through in the social media feeds. We thought we might talk about it in an episode of JRR You Talking to Me.
Because we're talking all the time.
That's right. And, you know, our third host, Rowan, he is on sabbatical in beautiful Spain. He's taken a little time off, and so we're doing it tonight sans Rowan.
We are winging it.
So anyway, again, the if you take a look at some of the titles, it's like epic disaster, failure. Will the showrunners commit suicide?
Worst show ever.
What happened? $1 billion disaster.
Bum, bum, bum.
Okay, so let's try to get in the weeds on this and talk about a couple of things. And I think the first thing, we're going to get sort of meta on this, and get into some of the culture wars a little bit about what's going on. Maybe how does Tolkien translate into modern culture, and how has this been divisive in the world of Amazon putting out a Tolkien show and Jeff Bezos running Amazon, and how does legitimate criticism of the show conflate with certain things that are maybe less objective and more cultural? So first, let's just talk about the role of feminism and cultural diversity in really how it relates to Tolkien's writing. So Jude, you got something to say about that stuff?
Yeah, I think that... when you go through Tolkien's work, there's a surprising amount of diversity as well as feminism, which is at play there. Now, I don't think he was necessarily the arbiter of these issues. However, he definitely did have certain characters which were clearly strong female characters. As well as an attempt at diversity in certain things. We have examples like the Harfoots themselves, who are described by Tolkien in, I believe it's his preamble to the Fellowship of the Ring, which is, I think it's called Concerning Hobbits or About Hobbits, something to that effect. And he describes them as being, I think, shorter and browner of skin. So there are examples of this scattered throughout his writings.
So what I want to do is just break down two competing concepts in Tolkien. Tolkien was trying to create a mythology for Britain, for the Northwestern European culture. And in that sense, it could be considered sort of ethnocentric. However, another theme in his writing is the unity of different races, particularly dwarves, elves, and men, to overcome prevailing evil. So on the one hand, you have an argument that some people can use as an anti-diversity argument. On the other hand, the other side has an argument for diversity and saying that, well, maybe if Tolkien were living today, writing today, or was younger, that he might have made some of the same decisions as the Rings of Power showrunners. If you extend the logic of his heterogeneous unity of different races to overcome evil.
Yeah, and I think that just the concept of him using these different races within his mythology of, again, the elves and the dwarves and the men as being somewhat of a metaphor for the world at large, we could see that as a concept of these different races, whatever they are, you can read into them as you will, coming together, as Rob had pointed out just before. And that's something that I believe a lot of people don't even really consider, you know, that that he considers them races of these humanoid people who can be construed as whatever you wish, however the reader wishes.
Okay, so that sort of begins to address the ethnic diversity issues, which we'll definitely get into more as we get into the nature of social media and what's going on about the show. But then, you know, we have this other issue of feminism in the show, and this idea that the feminism in Rings of Power is vastly different than something that Tolkien would write. And I just have to say that, you know, the term intersectional feminism seems to be thrown around a lot as a criticism of the overall culture that's created the show. Would that criticism be applied to Tolkien in his writing when the Witch King was killed by Théoden's niece? You know, Eowyn.
I think that he's definitely got examples of this feminine power scattered throughout. I mean, again, he was somebody that was writing at a certain time. He was male. He was from a certain culture, which definitely did not have the kind of ideas that we are holding close to 100 years later, you know, like 80 years later or so. But he definitely still had these progressive ideas throughout his writing, and it's something that is important to address when we move it up to the modern era.
Well, he definitely had the idea that the powerful were not always the most important or effective characters. So in that sense, he spoke truth to power. He was saying that even this race of tiny people, the hobbits, had this tremendous role to play. And he was paying homage to the working class British people who fought in World War I and how much admiration he had for the common man. And also for women. In this case, in the case of Eowyn, who defeats the Witch King,
mm-hmm.
she does it because she is no man.
Right.
And that was the prophecy. Peter Jackson didn't get much flack when he substituted Arwen for Glorfindel.
Yeah. Glorfindel, once again, was kind of crapped on a bit. But really, in a certain sense, to the empowerment of the movies and of the character.
Was that intersectional feminism when Peter Jackson put in Arwen instead of Glorfindel? I mean, I don't think so.
I guess,
certainly didn't blow up the same way.
No, if you want to define it like that, you could push that point, but no one did at the time, and I don't think it's a valid point to push.
But there are many valid points. However, when these points start to surface, I tend to think that there's more of a cultural bias against Amazon, Jeff Bezos, the showrunners, and trying to push or being accused of trying to push a certain political, social, cultural point of view, and doing it with the intent of warding off criticism, being above criticism because they're so woke. And, you know, I really think that that's not really a valid way to look at the show, in my opinion.
Yeah.
There are other things to criticize about the show that are much more important and much more valid and much more objective than those things.
Yeah, I think that the only real issue with adding more of the diversity, more of the feminist aspects to this is simply an issue of the creators and the company as well trying to be as inclusive and as progressive as possible in order to include as many people as they can in it. And I personally don't have an issue with that specifically. Again, plenty of issues, which we will get into, but that's just not one of them.
You know, it is, I mean, to be fair, the House of the Dragon did not receive the same negative criticism. It is, I think, objectively a better show, a more well-written show, and more compelling.
Agreed.
But, you know, they also, you know, have a culturally diverse cast and extremely strong female characters, and it just doesn't seem to be looked at with the same jaundiced eye as Amazon, Jeff Bezos, Rings of Power. I think that somewhere in that stew, it really puts people off.
And I would say that part of that does have to do with the fact that the original works, the way you interpret them, it is easier to interpret A Song of Ice and Fire in a more diverse way because Martin wrote a more diverse, more culturally divided world. His world building focuses on these different areas, these different peoples, in a way that Tolkien didn't and was not thinking of in that context.
Well, Tolkien's fantasy is creating a mythos. It's a mythological fantasy, and I feel like George R. R. Martin is more of someone who's using history as a basis and trying to be a little bit more fact-based and a little bit more science-based. In Martin's world, we have a lot of organized religion. We have a lot of organized education, organized science. There is magic, but there is also science. And that's just not the case in Tolkien's world. It's magical.
Yeah, and Tolkien was very much basing a lot of his mythology on various Nordic and Celtic myths and things of that nature, which were definitely a lot more ethnocentric, and Tolkien himself was known to be a great supporter of women in his teaching career, and about 50% of his class was female, which at the time was unusual. So I think in his personal life as well as in his writings, we see, again, a lot more than people tend to point out when they're discussing these things.
Right. So just at least establishing that, now we can say, let's look at some of the things that the show was weak on or got wrong, and let's leave that other meta discussion out of it and just take a look at the character development, the dialogue, and maybe use of certain devices, Deus Ex Machina kind of devices, or setting up these mystery boxes. Is that the most valid way to tell this tale, or is that just more of a ploy to keep people tuning in? So, first of all, there's a lot of criticism about Galadriel being a two-dimensional character that's in pretty much a god mode.
Boy, is there.
Overpowered. Now, there's nothing in Tolkien's lore in the Second Age, Galadriel and Celeborn are husband and wife, and they have various travels to various cities looking for a realm to establish. And they live under other elven lords in certain other realms. But there's nothing, Tolkien doesn't really get into Galadriel, the warrior, specifically.
No,
she's like a political, not really a political figure, just a leader.
I think he hints at a few things, but quite a bit of her history is definitely left up to the reader and up to mystery. And I think that nothing really in the show in terms of that aspect of her character necessarily goes against the lore. Now, if we want to speak more about the character development and things of that nature, I think that is where we have some valid points that can be brought up. I've definitely heard a lot of people say things like, this is not my Galadriel, or this is nothing like Galadriel. She's supposed to be the Lady of Light, and, you know, she's over there jumping around and killing orcs and killing trolls, and that's not Galadriel. Well, again, that is not, as far as I think we could find and everything we've read, which is quite, you know, a little bit more than your average bear, so to speak. There's nothing that necessarily goes against it.
Well, I will say this. Galadriel is of the Noldor, and the Noldor do have a history of being, you know, these overpowered warrior elves.
Yep.
With a serious attitude.
Yeah.
So she is a member of this group. She did cross the Helcaraxa, the ice bridge, to fight with the Noldor, even though she didn't necessarily, wasn't a big fan of her uncle Feanor. And she is oldest elves. Well, his sons.
Well, yeah.
Most of the Noldor.
Damn oath.
Kind of liked him.
That damn oath.
Well, at least the ones who went across on the boats. So anyway, so Galadriel, you know, the reimagining of her as this Noldor warrior, it's not beyond imagination. But then, you know, there is the question of, did they make her too two-dimensional in the service of then having her be the sort of doppelganger of Halbrand, Sauron, sort of them being two sides to the same coin, was that overdone in that sense? Did they make her too dimensional in order to have her character have this moral arc and this growth? And did they really need to do it in such a blatant way?
Yeah, I personally, as a writer, feel that they did, in fact, kind of subdue her emotion in a lot of senses. Not that she had no emotion, but she tended to show one or two emotions as opposed to a full range. And they were generally anger and sadness. And, you know, that makes for a somewhat two-dimensional character. In addition, generally, when writing, whether it's a movie or a season of a show, not generally an episode, but across a season, character development is so important. And you can argue that they attempted to give her a bit of a character arc where by the end of the season, she gives up her dagger and it meant so much and what have you. But I think that it really, from a writing standpoint, is sort of a little bit too little too late, rather, type of development for the character. And I think they could have gone a lot further with a little bit better writing in that sense. So I think she's a mixed bag in terms of the writing of her character.
Right. So then let's move on to Celebrimbor.
Yes.
Because I think that the problem here is a little bit deeper, because Celebrimbor is supposed to be this master craftsman. He's Feanor's grandson.
Halbrand even says so.
How does he not know about the alloy process?
It was not given any real hold on his character at all in this season. He was very much sort of this guy just going through it, as opposed to this master at his craft who should have been in charge.
So again, the criticisms coming through, these are some of them.
Yeah, and once again,
we're finding agreement with a bunch of it. And a lot of this we said on the show, and with Celebrimbor, the whole idea in Tolkien's lore is how much time it took to make these rings and how much time he spent with Annatar, with Sauron in disguise. And these are hundreds of years. This creates a vastly different story than the whatever, however many weeks or long weekend that it seemed that they were working on these rings, and how quickly he was swayed by Halbrand. We have such a condensed version of it that it can't help but lose a lot in translation from Tolkien's. So that is diminished from the lore.
Yeah.
And it doesn't live up to it in that sense. So points off for Celebrimbor, the shortness in duration of the rings, the Gwythe Merdain, those all disappointed in terms of from the Tolkien lore point of view.
And once again, another example of of an almost egregious lack of character development. And in the books, he is a very, very interesting character, and they have more time to explore that in future seasons. But as of now, for a show within the season, every character should have some sort of arc, and he really just didn't have.
But to be fair, in the Silmarillion, like, you don't really see the personalities of the characters. You only see their plot, their arc.
Right.
You don't really get to know what anyone is like. That's a blank slate, really.
Right, which is all the more reason that as a writer of a TV show, they had the ability to have these subtle character arcs and situations that would have given more depth. And we just, again, didn't get it. We got, you know, a very, very flat character in that sense, in that sense of the writing.
And in, I think it's the Celebrimbor situation is similar to Numenor in general. Celebrimbor and the Gwythi Merdine and the Forging of the Rings is all condensed, and Numenor is diminished in and made more typical. In other words, the typical height of a Numenorean is not 7 feet in the show, and I don't think it needs to be. But it would be nice if they were all of, like, a larger stature and just showed something more of the might of that civilization. We didn't really get the might of Numenor. I think even in Jackson's movies, we saw more might of Numenor just in the Last Alliance scene, you know? And what I was expecting more of would be like that Last Alliance scene in the prologue to the Jackson movie, which is these epic, like you see like 10,000 man armies. And now the way they frame the show, we're obviously building, and this is just season one. So that's what they get points for, it being season one, and they definitely have some place to go. And they say that they're going to address this, and they're going to make the show more epic, and they're going to make it darker, and they're going to build it up based on.
I think someone used criticism. The term gritty as well.
Gritty. That would be a good response, to this criticism. Adar really is probably the most compelling character, in a sense, because he has the most, I don't know, epic personality in the show. He's got a seemingly more a gritty backstory and a more grandiose sense of how he wants to change the world.
I would say Adar and perhaps Theo. Theo, is one of the few characters, I think, that had somewhat of an arc and, you know, some interesting development. Like, we don't know where his story is going. We want to see more of it. And these are both show original characters.
Right. So, again, you know, some positives and some negatives. You know, we do have some orc inconsistencies. We have sometimes they can handle sunlight better than other times. It seems to be used as a device to make the plot go in a certain way. For example, when they can't chase them out, I think is it Theo and
depends which time.
Bronwyn.
Are you talking about
they're chasing them out of the forest, but the orcs will not go out into the sunlight?
When Theo and Bronwyn are Arondir. Being led by Arondir. Is Bronwyn even there in that?
She's outside of it. It was right. Theo and Arondir.
Yeah, Arondir saves Theo.
All of
Theo.
A sudden, the sunlight is a very big issue, and yet
they
we
just
see
stop.
A couple of scenes later, they're in the sunlight fighting.
Yeah, when they're attacking the village, it's night, and then when day dawns, they're still fighting. They're trying to break into the tavern, and they fight the Numenoreans. They lose, but they fight them in the sunlight without issue. Meanwhile, when Adar has his orc there and he just holds his arm into the sunlight, it starts smoking. We actually see it, burning pretty much, right? Again, there are definitely inconsistencies with that, and it's an issue they need to be more careful of, both in the writing as well as in the filming. The directors should be aware of this on top of the writing. The script supervisor, who is the person responsible for keeping consistency during a shoot, should be addressing that. There are multiple levels of failure in that sense that hopefully we will see a little bit more attention go into
right
in the future.
So then we have another aspect of it, which is the mystery box storytelling process. Is that necessary for Tolkien? It's not really a thing in Tolkien's writing. Occasionally, George R. R. Martin, definitely he had some mysteries going in terms of the identity of certain characters, particularly in people reading the books.
Well, I think he still does, and I don't know if we're ever going to get answers, but that's another issue entirely.
But, just people were always coming up with who is who.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously you have the Faceless Men, so that brings a whole other area into it. In Tolkien, we have the changeling capacity, especially of Sauron. So the two, in one of the funnier videos, I think one of the guys says the mystery of the two mysteries is over. And so the whole season was the mystery of the two mysteries. What was the two mysteries? They were both who is Sauron, and it basically is Meteor Man Sauron, is Halbrand Sauron. We knew that the only reason that Halbrand wouldn't be Sauron is because it was too obvious that he was Sauron. That's what we really said all along. And then he just was Sauron. So it was kind of like a very shitty mystery box.
It was, there's a term in screenwriting that we use for this sort of thing. And I think it's very appropriate. And a lot of people haven't heard it. So I'm going to mention it. And I hope I can educate people a little bit here. But it's called lazy writing.
Or, they just didn't realize how much they were projecting who Sauron was, for this audience. You have a hive mind that you have to contend with. People are talking about the show and they're figuring things out, and information maybe is leaked as well. So the fact that Halbrand is Sauron theories from episode 2.
Right, well, part of that has to do with the fact that, and I am going to get down on the writing quite a bit here, but the writers of this show do not seem to understand how they need to set up a mystery, provide clues which an audience can figure out. However, while doing that, provide enough doubt and other possibilities that the audience won't necessarily get it. This way you have some members of your audience that will get the right answer, they'll derive at the right solution, and other ones that won't. Here, they pretty much put all their eggs in one basket, and, obviously that turned out to be the case in every single scenario that we set up.
Well,
from the Meteor Man, who is Meteor Man? Oh, he's either Gandalf or Lauren or something to that effect. Well, we kind of knew he was something to that effect. The same with Halbrand. Who is he? Well, he's got to be Sauron, and there were no real surprises. Any of these reveals that we got were something we all pretty much saw coming from a mile away. And
it was almost like we were waiting. We got so many reveals that we were waiting for it not to be the case.
Right.
But the more importantly is the inverse, which is the Mount Doom thing. We didn't get a single clue or Easter egg that this tunneling process was going to have to do with Adar's secret weapon that he's looking for, which is the key to turn this whole volcano on.
Yeah,
and that the tunnels had a lot to do with that. We could have been given something, and we watched the episodes a bunch of times before podcasting on it, and I didn't see anything to indicate at all, any clue that the tunnels would be part of this plot at the end.
Yeah, there were some...
So we couldn't figure that out.
Simple little things, which they could have added, you know. They could have had, the tunnels being used for irrigation or something. We got one little bit of, when Adar goes in the tunnel, oh, there's an underground river there. But it really wasn't enough to be able to deduce that, so again, it's kind of the same problem in writing. It's the exact same problem in not knowing what clues to put in and what to omit in order to give multiple possible outcomes to this situation to keep your audience guessing. And so it was either, oh, we know what's going on here, or, well, there's nothing to even discuss because we didn't have a clue. And it's two sides to that same coin, like you just said, Rob.
Well, and so there's now a related issue is the repetitive nature of some of the reveals, which become no longer reveals. And so what I mean is, in terms of Meteor Man, we had a repeated process where he would prove himself to be good, he would prove himself to be useful, and then he would do something that was out of his control, and he would scare the Harfoots, and they would not trust him. And this would happen again, and this would happen again. So instead of doing these repeated resets, basically, regain their trust and then lose it, regain their trust and then lose it, we could have had different sort of mysteries revealing themselves. But so the mystery box of the Meteor Man is Sauron versus Meteor Man is Gandalf or a blue wizard or some form of Istari, it could have been more interestingly done. Now, this sort of dovetails into my next point is, but there were some also really great aspects of this rendition of the Istari that I found really interesting and compelling. Like, I really liked this character, and I liked this character's slow reveal of who he was to himself. Even if we already guessed who he was, it was still interesting to watch a character of that power from another dimension, basically, discover its power. We haven't seen anything like that. Gandalf is Gandalf when we see him in Lord of the Rings or any of the movies. This is the origin story of the way he's going to be embodied in Middle Earth. That's interesting. And I thought it was really well done and original. I thought his fight, his wizard fight with the cult, with Eminem, his rap battle... I thought that was really well done. What was her name again? She's the Dweller.
The Dweller, right. I almost said the Aesthetic. The other one was the Nomad, I believe.
The Aesthetic and the...
The Dweller and the Nomad.
Right. Not the Aesthetic. The Aesthetic.
The Aesthetic.
So the...
The Nomad's the one who stabbed... Stab Static.
Right. And you know
I'm mad at her.
A lot of really there's a lot of good and some bad. And I think ultimately for season one of a new show, it's positive. It could have been better. And of course, like we discussed it, we wished that they had the Silmarillion. That they can use and tell some of those tales, and maybe some of those tales would be better told in a different format, like an animated format, because they are so almost surrealistic in terms of their epic nature. But so you know, like for example, that the cult, the People's Republic of Sauron, or whoever
the
they
People's
are.
Temple of Sauron.
So, you know, there's. Right. I thought there were a lot of really cool aspects about it, but, you know, one of the weaker points of the show, and this is not Sauron. Like, they just look at each other like, that's not Sauron. I mean, that was a little, you know, kind of on the nose.
See, again, they really needed some rewrites on this, and this is a show that. Should have had, they did have, let me take that back, they did have plenty of money and plenty of time for that.
Like the most money.
And for some reason, we didn't get it, you know. I can't explain it, but a lot of the issues with the writing, and again, there are a few more, but like a lot of the issues.
It's intersectional feminism.
Well, I guess that must be
let's
it.
Blame that.
You know, that must be it, and not the fact that it feels like a lot of that, like these writers didn't go to film school or didn't read the basic books on screenwriting, and I can't understand it. Like, you know, they're. Very fundamental things that they objectively got wrong that they didn't do. And
I think there's going to be a learning curve for this is like a these are new showrunners. They gave them a lot of rope, you know.
Perhaps too much.
And there's going to be a learning curve. And you know what? I think they're going to learn because you know for some of the now. Within the context of all the negative stuff that's happening in social media, and particularly YouTube, but I'm seeing like all these prospects for the future of the show, and some people are suggesting there's going to be, you know, just a page one rewrite, just a complete reboot. Of the entire show,
there is that.
Some think that the showrunners are going to be the Fall Guys and take all the blame and be just maybe there in name only, while other right. people run the show.
Well, we got that rumor coming from Chris Gore from Film Threat, who's a fairly reliable source, and I have a lot of respect for Chris Gore. That might. Very well be what happens that he's heard that, you know, from a source. And I can definitely see that happening more than a complete rewrite and they just toss out the show. I don't think Amazon as a company is going to be willing to do that. We'll see how those cards fall, but you know.
Well, first of all, let's talk about the Rotten Tomatoes of it all. So
let's talk about that. That's kind of an interesting.
The main claim from a lot of the people that I think want to see the show fail, they say that the show had fewer viewers from episode to episode.
Right, which is
sure if that's true or not.
It's not the least typical thing. Sometimes shows will decline. You know, if it's a huge show that. A lot of people tune in for, you get some people that go, it's not for me. If it's a show that's a smaller show, more like a Breaking Bad or something like that, where You get small initial numbers, and people go, hey, this is amazing, and they tell their friends. A lot of times that's what you want. But when it's such a big show, the idea that it might dwindle off a little bit is not super uncommon. And I don't feel that it's something that's such a worry for the company like that. But,
well, what do we have? We have 39% audience.
Yep.
Favorability on Rotten Tomatoes and 85% critics. So a lot of people look at that number as doctored by Amazon.
I mean, the thing is, it's the funny part is, yeah, you have to say, oh, well, maybe Amazon is, you know, just paying these critics to ruin their careers and, you know, say something that they don't believe, which I can't say it's not possible, but it's a hell of a lot easier to get bots and angry people that will create multiple accounts and to just review bomb something, which we know did happen, at least to some extent, with this show. So if you take Occam's Razor, what is more likely, you know, what's the simpler solution? The idea that the audience score was review bombed is probably more likely than we had Amazon paying all these critics, because no matter how many you pay, you're not going to really, I think it's going to be tough to get that high of a score. So
I think there are a couple of forces at work. I think you had a lot of people tune in the very beginning to check out the show. And I think just like every show, you're going to have some fall off from that. And then some people will eventually actually return.
Yeah, well, that's show. What I was just saying about that
and,
part of it.
But in the case of this show, you had such a large amount of people tune in for the first two episodes just to check it out, you're going to have a proportionate size fall off.
Yeah.
So maybe that's kind of happening. Expected,
like I said.
Then you have some sort of meta numbers, like the numbers on TikTok, where you have House of the Dragon getting, you know, 7 billion views for the TikTok comments on the show, whereas Rings of Power only getting 800 million views on TikTok
for the same type of thing. That was the hashtags, actually.
Right.
That's not the TikTok. That's the hashtags.
I wrote it down as we were reviewing it.
Okay, but those are definitely hashtags. So that'll go.
That's what I'm saying. It's meta information,
right? That
indicates
that goes from TikTok, though, Facebook. That's counted amongst Twitter. You know, that's the hashtags for all the social media, I believe.
Right. So, but we're just comparing to the hashtags of House of the Dragon.
Right. I'm just saying it's not just TikTok.
Okay.
It's the entire social media spectrum. But those hashtags, they are significant.
So you have a show like House of the Dragon, which didn't get as many initial views, getting all these other hits.
Yeah.
Much more than Rings of Power. So
that is significant.
Right.
That number.
And House of Dragon was a better show.
Yeah.
So did the audience size shrink to the point where Rings of Power has to be completely transformed to come back? I don't think so. I think that's an exaggeration.
And I think those numbers are very likely being kept internal, and we may never know specifically, but we will have an idea of that depending on what action we see the company take, you know, in the coming months and years before season two.
Lindsay Weber, who is a producer in the show, and this is what I hope the criticism changes. And what she's saying is the new season will be grittier, more intense, and maybe a little scarier now that Sauron's true identity is finally out in the open. So, okay, Sauron's true identity. Whatever. We could have guessed that from episode two. If it wasn't so obvious, we would have. So,
I think from episode four.
I like grittier, really, more intense, and scarier. That sounds good to me. If they make those corrections, and let's face it, the show has to get more epic. There should be more world building in terms of when we go into the various cities. One of the critics pointed out pretty correctly that, you know, we see certain aspects of the elven cities. We see them sitting at a table. We see them in a courtyard. We don't see the elves, though. We don't see them doing a lot. And
doing a lot of elven things.
Right. And we don't necessarily get the stories at the campfires, and Peter Jackson did that really well. You know, the Sam and Frodo scenes, the Pippin and Merry going into the forest, and Treebeard and talking to Treebeard, a lot of conversations happening. Gandalf and Pippin, that's another big one, when they start to break off into pairs and they really bear their souls to each other in the journey. It's the friends we make along the way aspect of it. We need to see a little bit more of that stuff happening in the show. So in addition to grittier, more intense, and a little scarier, maybe also
a little more competent world building.
We've got a big inside world. The dwarven, like when we got that ceremony in Khazad Dûm
that was interesting. Was leading.
Yeah. That was great. We got to see a congregation of dwarves. We're not seeing a big congregation. We did see Numenor. You know, there was the Chuck E. Cheese in Numenor where Elendil took the kids.
Yep. And then we had the bar where
the Hooters.
They were singing. Yep.
So, you know, we did get some of Numenor, although, you know, again, we expected Numenor to be, you know, a bunch of Dolph Lundgrens walking around in a giant, giant city.
Yeah.
That had thousands of ships in the dock. They could have done that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that being said, I think there is some question as to whether, and we finally have slightly more accurate numbers in terms of exactly how much the show cost. We were throwing around numbers that had come out early on before, but now we have much more accurate numbers. So apparently the episodes broke down to approximately 58.125 million dollars per episode. So, you know, a little under $60 million an episode. Did we really see a $60 million an episode show when we had something like Game of Thrones, which I believe like was half. Somewhere around 10? No, I think the original series, I think by the last season, they were spending somewhere in the range of around $10 million an episode. It was like $100 million for the season. So this is almost six times what Game of Thrones season 7 was costing. And that, you know, I mean, say what you will about going off book and the writing of that, it looked amazing. We had dragon fights and epic sea battles with dragons and, you know, King's Landing under siege and being destroyed. And this, for six times that budget, did we get that epic spectacle? I don't think we did, and I am questioning why it cost that much.
Objectively speaking, we did not.
Yeah, why I question why it cost that much. I mean, you know, we know they spent $250 million on the rights. All right, great. That's not counted as part of this episode budget. The Harfoots,
those Blackfeet.
Oh, they did cost, I'm sure, many millions of dollars for the berries. You know, they had to be a little bigger to make them look right. So, I don't know. I can't explain it. As somebody that's been in the industry, It's a mystery to me. And we'll see what season two brings. But I would like more. I would like that epic feel. You know, I would like to see when you see like a flashback that we saw in episode one here. Yeah, we liked the eagle fighting the fell beast, and we liked, you know, seeing that clash, but it wasn't super epic. We saw one fell beast and one eagle. We saw maybe a couple hundred orcs and elves.
You gotta have
at the
like
most.
A full
not thousands.
Right. The battle that we get is, you know, three Numenorean ships worth of average sized Numenorean dudes, not epic Ubermensch. We get, you know, a couple of villages worth of folk fighting off, I don't know, a couple thousand orcs, maybe.
I don't think it was anywhere near that.
Not even a couple thousand orcs, a couple hundred orcs.
You know, a couple hundred? If there was a couple, it might have been closer to 100. Like, it was just, again, I'm not saying that a lot of it was done poorly, but it just didn't have the scale that I think we expected from this budget of a show, of a TV show.
Like, right. That said, though, a lot of really cool things and a lot of really great things, and the story can go somewhere great. People who don't read the books, people who didn't like Tolkien, tend to really, really like the show a lot. The casual viewer tend to really, really love the show, I found.
Yeah.
And, you know, is it good television? It's definitely good television.
It's good. Is it great?
Not yet.
That's the thing.
It has the potential to be great. It was entertaining and... Yeah. I don't think, you know, the dialogue got a lot of slack. I think the dialogue could be better. You know, there are some fun that the dialogue wasn't as much of a problem for me as some other problems.
There were definitely a few, once again, with the rewrite potential. Like, there were some lines that we talked about this as we reviewed the shows, but, you know, things like the sea is always right. Is it, though?
It is always right.
You know...
Have you ever argued with the sea?
You know, just because it's stubborn doesn't make it right.
Basically, all that is you can't control the world. The world's going to fucking control you. That's all that means. It's give your power up.
I think they could have... come up and should have come up with a better line, though, a more poetic line.
Yeah, they probably could have done that.
You know, I think to invoke Tolkien, you need the poetry, and you need someone who can handle that poetry, and I don't think they
had it. I think they were looking for some George R. R. Martin type of thing, because, winter is coming. That's pretty cool.
But that works better
right,
for some
that's
reason.
Better.
And, like, I think they just didn't have the writers there that they needed, you know. There was the line of, you know, I know what you've been doing in the dark of night, and when you think no one is watching, like nobody, you know, like,
yeah.
Nobody said there, that's not right. Like, let's change that. In the writer's room, much less on set, much less the director, there's levels of this, you know, and it's inexcusable, you know, and of course our favorite, you know, give me the meat and give it to me raw. Like,
I think they put that in just for you.
Oh, just like they need to do better, though. They really do. And they can do better. I have hopes that they will, but come on, just let's see it.
So, yeah, you know, I say for me it's about a 6.5 out of 10.
I think I'm about the same.
But I thought House of the Dragon was like a 9.
I would go, you know, 9.5 on that one, pushing 10.
Wow.
So, like, you know, I think there's a big discrepancy, and I hope we get better. We'll find out, and we'll be there for it.
Bottom line, I think season two, they're gonna kick it up a notch. They're gonna do what it takes to answer the critics. I think they kind of have to. They spent enough money. I think the passion is there. I don't ascribe the negative intentions that some of the critics put on everyone involved in the show, and saying that they're doing this and they're doing that and they have this agenda. To me, that's exhausting. I don't think it's true. I just think that, you know, that I'd like to see more along the lines of the Peter Jackson movies. And then again, we saw some of the things that Peter Jackson, you know, didn't think of, or maybe were a little bit even better done. I really, you know, I'm thinking of the Istari versus the, what's her name?
The Dweller.
I really like the way that was done, and I like the concept of Meteor Man finding who he was.
Let me just tell you that People's Temple of Sauron, when they offer you the Kool-Aid, don't drink it.
The Harfoots, I found them to be pretty soulful, believable ancestors of the hobbits. The fact that they had this nomadic life that was fraught with danger explains a lot. I thought that
could have done without them being quite so willing to, you know, let their own die. But, you know, again, it's,
they're like rodents.
Like, that's I mean, it's once again kind of a bit of a learning process.
But they're gonna outgrow that because of Nori.
Yeah,
Nori's gonna lead them out of that. I think if they're gonna imply that Elrond and Durin have a homosexual relationship, they should just be mature about it instead of making little jokes. Maybe address it forthright.
Yeah, do it directly, and if there's flack for it, which there will be, you know,
then or don't do it at all. Happen.
Yeah, it's, you know, be on one side of the fence or the other would be nice.
You know,
but
So I think, we covered pretty much that. Ultimately, like I said, my hopes is that season two is not – they're not going to do a reboot from ground up.
Yeah,
I sincerely doubt that. Unless, if they got the rights to the Silmarillion and then did that, that would be cool. But that's not happening.
Keep dreaming.
So that's what I think it's going. They're going
to
kick it up.
And by the way, we know who does have the rights to that now, and it's not Amazon, and it won't be.
You know what they're going to do? They are going to make it a little bit more like House of the Dragon, since I think House of the Dragon ate their lunch a little bit.
They did have dragons,
and that's what I wanted from the beginning. Okay, so this has been the JRR You Tolkien to Me podcast. I'm Rob Law, and I am going to give it up to Jude to take us out.
And I'm Jude Fox, and if you'd like to contact us, you can email us at youtalkingtome@gmail.com. Join our Facebook group at You Talking To Me About The Fellowship. And I just want to remind everyone to like, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating wherever you find your podcasts, and share with your friends to help grow the fellowship. For now, bye-bye. Mm-hmm.